This is another edition of Radio Warner. This is episode 41, and I'm the co-host Mark Ames. I'm coming to you from Queens, New York, and I'm on the line with the Warner, Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan. And John, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah. And where are you?
We're back in Phnom Penh. We went to Siem Reap, saw our quota of temples, and returned in pretty quick time, because Siem Reap is one of those gateway towns, you know, tourist towns, home of the hard sell. And we weren't used to that. I don't associate Southeast Asia with the hard sell. It kind of sits badly on the culture. But in a place like Phnom Penh or Bangkok, those are big cities where people go about their own affairs, and you're just a kind of sideline. But in Siem Reap, you are the, you know, you are the herbivore, and everybody around there thinks of you as the base of the food pyramid, and it's not much fun. So we came back in a hurry.
I see. So, yeah, because last time when we left off, you basically challenged the Angkor Wat ruins to change your mind on visiting ruins, and it sounds like they weren't up to the challenge. So
no, I don't like ruins very much. The only ruin that ever really, and it's not quite a ruin, the only ruin that really got to me was the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, and that one is just too sad. And other ruins leave me, I mean, cathedrals, mosques, temples, whatever, they leave me pretty cold. I'm one of those Philistines for whom photographs are perfectly adequate. If I see a photograph of a place and it looks just like the photograph, I know there's some high culture reason why I shouldn't accept the photograph, but I don't get it. You know, yeah, looks just like the pictures. I've seen the pictures. Okay. The only difference is I'm not likely to get malaria from looking at the picture.
Exactly. Well, so this has been a really busy week, you know, in terms of Warner news, and it's a really bloody week. It's been a bloody month that you'll talk about in a minute, and, you know, the whole Ramadan month. And then, of course, just in the last few hours, and it's one of these stories, again, that's unfolding just as we start the show, the shootings in Dallas. So we're not going to be able to say that much about it. But what we know right now is that, among other things, the police put out a photo of the wrong guy initially, because he was it was a African-American guy in the Black Lives Matter march in Dallas, was walking around with the open carry, because that's the law there. So everybody assumed that it was this guy, and he was actually just a normal guy. Immediately ran to the police, begging not to be shot, and handing them his gun. You know, I mean, it was very, I mean, the guy's lucky to be alive, frankly. The other thing I think we know is that the one that we know who is, there was at least one sniper, but the police are saying there were maybe two, maybe three, maybe four. The one sniper they know for sure is dead. He was killed. He was killed by a police robot, which had a bomb extended at the end of some extension, and they drove the robot up next to him, I presume. He kind of holed himself up somewhere where he was hard to reach, and they were sort of trying to negotiate with him all night, and didn't work. And then they claimed he was maybe going to make a run for it. I mean, he'd already killed five policemen if it was him. And so they detonated the bomb and killed him that way. I don't know how often that's happened. I haven't heard.
No, it sounds fairly new. It's a strange method of killing somebody, but I suppose at this point they're trying to avoid further police casualties, and it's definitely a safe way of killing somebody. The only thing exposed to sniper fire is this machine. Although I would have thought a robot like that would be fairly fragile, and you could hit it, unless they now have armored police robots.
Yeah, they probably do. I mean, I think the Iraq War and maybe Afghanistan, they did a lot to advance, working with, you know, Silicon Valley, to advance this sort of robot technology.
Yeah,
in a lot of different ways, and you know, as wars do, those technologies then often are applied back at home on us.
Yeah, I mean, it's so far all I've heard is chaos, and one of the things that's uncertain right now is how many snipers were involved. Normally, there's always a report of more people than turn out to be involved. If it was one person, you always hear there was a second and a third shooter. If there are two shooters, you'll hear there were five or something like that. But in this case, somebody managed to shoot 11 police and kill five out of the 11. And that's rather impressive, using the term non-normatively. So it seems in this case it might be possible there was more than one shooter.
It's possible, but I was telling you, it reminded me a bit of this sort of lost episode in American history when we were younger, when there was a single sniper who killed a lot of people and was explicitly out to kill police and white people. His name was Mark Essex. And he was in, so he joined the Navy. He's a very average guy from Kansas, African-American guy, average student, you know, remembered as a decent kid and so on. Went and joined the Navy, went out to San Diego. And there he was, I was just looking through some old articles. He was apparently bullied a lot by the white people in the Navy that he was assigned with, and he wound up meeting a black Muslim, black nationalist, and becoming very radicalized. And this is the time when a lot of people were getting very radicalized. This is 1969, 1970. He was discharged, and he wound up becoming just increasingly radicalized. And a few sort of parallels to last night. Shortly after police in Louisiana killed two Baton Rouge University students, he snapped apparently and decided he was going to go out and kill a lot of white people. So he sent in a kind of manifesto to a local news station, killed a few people outside of jail. But what he was most known for is he wound up running into a Howard Johnson's, if you remember those motels. This is a 18 or 20 story Howard Johnson's in downtown New Orleans. And he killed a bunch of people in there and set off firecrackers, set fires, went up on the roof, killed police who were showing up, killed firemen. And they were convinced for days after, and weeks even, and until final inquiries a couple years later, that there had to have been more than one. But it turned out most likely there was just one shooter. Right. They pinned down, at one point, they had 600 policemen, and the Marines brought in a Seahawk, a CH-46 helicopter with, I don't even know if that's illegal in this country, but they did it anyway, with guys armed with M-16s. They unloaded literally thousands of rounds, and this guy had found like a sort of fortified position at the top of the hotel on the roof, sort of like a really thick concrete bunker. And they finally, after hours, flushed him out and I was reading the reports at the time that they killed him with 200. He was shot 200 times. Wow. They said they had to scoop his body parts off the roof. It's a really brutal story.
And oddly enough, I mean, I lived through that, but I have no memory of it.
Yeah.
I guess there was a lot going on in 1973, but that story didn't seem to make a big impression.
I know. I wonder why. Is it because it took place, in the South? Or because it was... killing cops. I mean, I wonder why.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that a lot of things were forgotten from that era, and that might just have been one that was dropped when mourning in America broke again.
Mm-hmm. So, according to the police, at least the shooter that they had killed with the robot had said during this sort of period of negotiations that he wanted to kill white police officers. That was what he wanted to do. He was against whites. And again, this guy, Mark Essex, when they went into his apartment in New Orleans, like outside of New Orleans, they found all this graffiti, which is all about, revolution, kill white pigs, kill white cops, pigs. I mean, it was kind of standard, more like Black Liberation Army, radical stuff. And we talked about the Black Liberation Army a bit in the SLA episode. So in any event, it's still, we still don't know much. I mean, honestly, the police had initially said, this is right next to Dealey Plaza, that they had been essentially ambushed in a triangulation by at least two snipers. I'm going to hazard a wild guess here and say I'll bet you there was only one.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right. I mean, I said it would be hard to kill five police and shoot 11, but I suppose yes. If they're lined up along the route of a parade and you have a vantage point, it probably isn't that hard. I mean, it wasn't hard for Omar Mateen to kill 49 people, and he had no particular skills.
The other thing is that the Dallas police, I mean, what's so horrible about this story, among other things, is that Dallas police actually have instituted all kinds of reforms, and they actually have quite a good record when it comes to, you know, not abusing the local African-American community. And they were walking with the Black Lives Matter protesters and tweeting out photos with together. So they were very well integrated and very relaxed. They didn't feel threatened. And so that might have made them easier targets. But the other thing is, I don't know if you saw that one video. It's pretty clear, I think, that the guy had serious body armor on, because one of the cops, and you can see him get killed. It's a brutal clip. One of the cops actually shot him a couple times, and he just kept going right after the cop and shot him in the back, and then went over and shot him a few times in the head.
Yeah, it's a very scary video. Yes. I saw that. It's like a kid's game, only these are real bullets. Yes. I mean, the cop shoots him, he runs around the pillar, but the cop expects him to come around one side of the pillar. Yeah. He comes around the other side, hits the cop, who might also have been wearing body armor, knocking him down, and then shoots him in the head a few times.
Yeah. And you see all that dust coming up nearby him, and apparently that was other cops trying to shoot him. But I mean, either he got really lucky, or he had body armor. And, you know, again, Texas is a state where
that's always the funny thing about the militia excuse. Like, wouldn't a militia also have RPGs? Wouldn't a militia have landmines? I mean, for some reason, and it has nothing to do with anything except American firearms culture. For some reason, even the NRA, as far as I know, does not demand that everybody be allowed to buy a surplus RPG.
Or even a machine gun.
Yeah, and yet why not?
It's a good question. I don't know. Why not even a machine gun that's still shaped like a gun?
Yeah.
But they don't agitate for a machine gun. They get close to it, but they don't actually agitate for it. I think they understand politically it would be bad, and maybe the manufacturers understand it would be a problem. I mean, ultimately, you know, one part of that equation is the manufacturers, and the other part is the crazy gun culture. So, you know.
Right.
Maybe the manufacturers wouldn't want to push for that themselves and be liable for that. So anyway, that's...
I mean, the idea behind this sort of thing on both sides, and there's quickly developing another side, is and this will provoke, you know, the same race war that Charlie Manson and a bunch of other people have been agitating for a long time. But I don't know. I mean, Joe Walsh, ex-Congress guy, just tweeted something like, "This means war. Black Lives Matter. We're coming for you." And so a lot of people are clearly eager for this to provide kindling for what they imagine to be a winnable war. But I don't know. America's a pretty strongly governed country. There have been a lot of attempts to start the all-out war, and they rarely succeed.
Yeah, they're just going to be opportunists, I think, especially in show business. Alex Jones was starting, he said, the race war, civil war starting. I think they cover the New York Post civil war. But, you know, it doesn't feel at all the same as what I remember as a young kid in the 70s. I mean, that was many, many years in the making before, like, a real big backlash.
Yes.
Many years, and this isn't. I mean, this time around, you know, it's been a one-sided war for decades. And then last year at Ferguson, somehow things just snapped. And if you ask me, a lot of this is all fallout from the Iraq War disaster. I mean, it reminds me of the fallout from the Vietnam War disaster. People start questioning everything at some point.
Yes, yes. And I have to say, one of the interesting things for me, I'm looking at this from abroad, is the sudden disappearance of the "we should care about every life in Iraq as much as every life in America." I mean, as far as I know, there have been 7 dead in America, But no one on any part of the American political spectrum seems very interested at the moment in the, by my count, 327 Iraqis who died this week. Suddenly, all that focus is on one or the other group of the seven Americans, the two African-American motorists who were killed or the five cops. I don't know the ethnicity of the cops who were killed. But the idea that we must care equally about all lives over the world has just vanished, which makes me suspect, as I always have suspected, that it's mainly a trope in domestic Western political arguments. You bring up the unmourned Iraqi dead, not because you really care very much about the unmourned Iraqi dead, but because you're playing some domestic political game against some faction that wants you to care about some other group of dead people.
Yeah, exactly. It's fairly common. And I think that these days, and I think it's sped up a lot by Twitter, where everyone is trying to, you know, foist their outrage juice on the public. Yeah. And you know, it's like an outrage competition there. And then you'll grab some other atrocity to try to negate somebody's, you know.
Yeah, that's why I had to get off Twitter. It's like high school cafeteria cliques in a divinity school. That horrible mixture of self-righteousness and just pure meanness.
Yeah. Public virtue, you know.
Yeah.
Getting back to what happened, what you were just talking about in Iraq, I mean, I saw you made here a list, this horrific list of all the massacres that have gone on from during the Ramadan month.
Yeah.
Start with this?
Yeah. It's been quite a Ramadan month. Ramadan is, I'm sure people know Ramadan is a very important month in all variants of Islam, Shia and Sunni. It's the month when the Quran was brought down to the mortal world, and to commemorate that, Muslims are supposed to fast from sunup till sundown, unless you're traveling or you're a soldier or a certain other thing. And believe me, I've listened to lots of arguments about what exceptions can be made during Ramadan, but Ramadan is also the month that you're supposed to demonstrate your commitment, and for some Wahhabi-oriented Muslims, that means acts of jihad. And there have been a lot of actions. I mean, I'm just trying to keep things to incidents that cause double-figure fatalities. And Ramadan began on June 6th this year. It's a lunar calendar, so Ramadan always begins at a different time. This year, June 6th. Islamic State killed 27 people in Fallujah right on June 6th. And this is one of the patterns you see for all the violence during Ramadan. As Islamic State loses territory, and it's been losing a lot of territory, it's gone from controlling 40% of Iraq to only 15%, it takes revenge. You see this endlessly. I mean, death camps are generally a feature of groups that are starting to be defeated. I would say that goes for Andersonville in the U.S. Civil War. It had a lot to do with the increasing craziness of the Third Reich as it began to lose on the Eastern Front. As groups begin to lose the bigger war, they want to kill anybody who's still killable. They want to do it now while they can. I mean, even the Soviet Union, when it was being pushed back on the Eastern Front, for a while there, it was the Nazis exposing mass graves because the Soviets were killing anybody that the NKVD thought might be unreliable in the future while they could, because they were going to have to withdraw. Yeah, they were going to have to withdraw. And the simplest way to deal with people who are unreliable when you're going to have to withdraw is kill them, because then they're not going to give you any more problem. So that's one pattern, and it's typical of Islamic State this Ramadan. And then June 12th, story a lot of people probably know, 49 mainly Hispanic, gay, men and women, killed at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando by a Pashtun American named Omar Mateen. June 13th, next day, there's a revenge killing in Fallujah by Shia, 49 civilians. June 14th, a Muslim militia in the Central Arab Republic kills villagers. There's another massacre.
Central African Republic?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. So there, yeah, this some of this is happening on the fringes of the Muslim world. Most of it is happening in very familiar places like Iraq. June 16th, there are two separate major massacres by Islamic State. And again, it's killing civilians while you can. The forces are withdrawing, and you're killing anybody you think of as unreliable, or you're just killing them out of revenge. June 17th, one of the stranger stories, 24 women shot dead at a funeral by Boko Haram. I don't know why. Boko Haram is a strange group, even by the standards of jihadists. Why all women? Why at this funeral? I mean, it's hard to get good information out of Nigeria, so I really don't know. And then more in Iraq, more Islamic State killings as they withdraw. Some killings in Afghanistan, 20 Kurds executed in Al-Bab in Syria for refusing to pledge allegiance to Islamic State, again, because Islamic State is losing ground in Syria as well. Al-Bab is in the north, and the Kurdish armed groups are pushing towards it from Manbij. So it's a good time to kill Kurds who won't, you know, grovel to you while you can. So they were killing people there. And then, again, more towards the fringes of the Muslim world, an attack in Mogadishu by al-Shabaab. But this is a different pattern. Al-Shabaab tends to target foreigners, outsiders, as in many cases, there's not so much Somali on Somali killing as xenophobic killing, and these two things are hard to separate. In some cases, like Dhaka, the big thing that we'll talk about later in Dhaka, there was a lot of xenophobia there. This was at one of those Mogadishu hotels that advertises, you know, nice safe place if you're an NGO type. And I wonder how they still sell that to anybody. I don't think there are any safe hotels or cafes in Mogadishu. I mean, we've been some places, but you would have to pay me a lot to go to Mogadishu. Sad thing is, I'd probably go. But
yeah, I was going to say the hardship pay, is probably pretty high.
Yeah, although when I was still looking for Tesla jobs, there was one in Djibouti, right on the point of the Horn of Africa, not a very safe place, and they were paying something like $35,000 a year, like $35,000 a year just to go to Djibouti. Even if you don't get killed, that's not very much money, because Tesla, in case anybody out there is still thinking that would be a good career to fall back on, it would be, to quote Thurber, very much like falling back on a keg of nails. Don't do Tesla. There are so many desperate liberal arts grads out there that they don't even pay you to go to dangerous places anymore. Mm-hmm. Anyway, back to our grim recital here. People calling themselves Islamic State in Yemen killed 40 people from the Sunni regime, oddly enough. Islamic State in Yemen is fighting for control of the Sunni part of the country, and they mainly kill other Sunni Yemeni Arabs. So all these things have very different faces. Then another story that most people probably know, because there's no doubt that some of these stories get a lot more coverage than others. This one got a lot. 41 people dead. I think it went up to 44 dead. Hundreds injured at Istanbul's Atatürk Airport on June 28th. by three Islamic State volunteers who came back from Syria. And this one was odd because there have been many, many interviews with Islamic State defectors and others who say, we love Turkey. Turkey is our best friend. I walked across the border and the Turkish police waved to me and said hello. There are all kinds of stories like that. But it seems that Turkey is trying to do some kind of mid-course pivot back toward alliance with the U.S. and Russia because they're losing a lot of money being on the outs with both of them. And there, it may be that some people in Islamic State and some people in Turkish intelligence don't like that. They want to stick with their old Islamic State alliance. So somebody, three in right, with automatic rifles and suicide vests and kill a lot of people at this Atatürk airport in the very center of Istanbul. Then another massacre targeting Kurds on June 29th in Tal Abyad, Syria. And the Kurds are winning on the battlefield. These have a sort of spite massacre feel to it, the massacres against them. Then another story that most people will know about, 20 foreigners, mostly Italians and Japanese, killed at a very upscale diplomatic quarter bakery in Dhaka, Bangladesh. And this one attracted a lot of attention because, first of all, they were foreigners, and it was an upscale cafe, and the killers were also upscale. People would like to believe that all jihadi killers are somehow, I don't know, disadvantaged or poor or the wretched of the earth, and this is not the case. These were middle-class kids. They'd all gone to, not all, but a couple of them had a school called Scholastica, which is very well-regarded, very expensive in Dhaka. I was looking at a forum of former Scholastica students, and mainly they were arguing in totally fluent English about whether the girls there are actually hot or not. I mean, they could have been talking about a private school in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. But that is not as surprising as people seem to think it is.
I was going to say Weathermen. Yeah. And not only that, 9/11. I mean, there a lot of those guys were pampered, middle, upper middle class Saudis.
Well, they were Saudis. If you're a Saudi citizen, you are not poor by definition. There are no poor Saudi citizens. The state gives you everything you want. So, I've even read breakdowns of the demographics of Quantrill's Raiders, the nastiest group of Confederate murderers who organized themselves as an irregular cavalry in Missouri and Kansas. And the old story was, to quote Charles Portis, whom I admire but whose politics are insane, he has a veteran of that group say, we did the best we could with what we had. We didn't have nothing but horses and revolvers. Well, in fact, Quantrill's Raiders turned out to be mostly middle and upper middle class kids who kind of found killing Yankee civilians pretty thrilling. They were not disadvantaged people. There are a lot of disadvantaged white Civil War soldiers, but they tended to enlist in the infantry, not these elite cavalry who specialized in killing civilians. So it's really not that.
Do you have a theory on that? On why we are surprised and why a lot of these people might be from, you know, the upper class, upper middle class? I mean, it doesn't surprise me that much, but I think we've grown up with some kind of expectation that any of these fighters must be somehow oppressed and therefore poor. And driven to this by some sense of oppression rather than a sense of entitlement. I mean, yes. A lot of revolutionaries through history got there through a sense of entitlement in the sense that you know, they should be shaping things. That comes from the confidence of being upper class.
Yeah, well, I think the whole field of liberal arts is confused about whether they're clergy or whether they're scholars. And as clergy, they want a world moral sense and which can turn into a sermon very easily. And if you claim that this sort of violence is always the product of repression, then you have a stable moral world and a platform for a sermon. But I'm sitting here in Cambodia. It's hard to think of a country with a more nightmarish history than Cambodia. And you don't find a lot of Cambodians taking random revenge on civilians around the world. The United States did horrific things to Vietnam, much more horrific even than Cambodia.
And Laos.
And you do not find Vietnamese people committing horrible atrocities around the world because of that oppression. They should have been expected to do so. I mean, I talked a while ago about watching that documentary about the fall of Saigon, and they left thousands of collaborators of the U.S. occupation on the ground with the full expectation they'd be tortured to death, but they weren't. That's not what happened. The Vietnamese had the discipline and the hardcore nationalist project to refrain from killing all their enemies. What we have here is something very different. I mean, if oppression creates this kind of violence, where are all the Congolese terrorists? There's no place I can think of that's had a worse history. Yeah. Where are they?
So, I mean, the real thing we need to look at is why we have this expectation, this false expectation. Like you said, I thought that was a great line that if your assumption is that it's oppression that makes for this violence, then you have the perfect platform for your moral sermon. I mean, that's...
There's something else going on here. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, a lot of these are very wealthy countries. One of the things, once you've lived in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, that really strikes you as bizarre is the way people tend to think of these countries as victims. And I don't really understand that. There are victims in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, very, very pitiable victims, but they're not the Saudis and they're not the Kuwaitis. They're mainly South Asians, and they're treated like slaves by the people there because these are very wealthy countries. I mean, there are a lot of very poor countries that are not generating a lot of terrorism, and a lot of the countries that are quite rich.
I mean, I'm trying to think. I guess the idea is that we forced Saudi Arabia to be allies with us, and we forced Wahhabism on them or something in order to get their oil, and therefore they're victims. I'm trying to think through the algebra of this, and it doesn't quite make sense. Except that if you applied the same algebra, then in a sense, Britain, which you could see as being forced into the alliance with America because America's all powerful, Britain's a victim in everything they do. I mean, I don't know.
Well, you know, there was a lot of that in Tony Blair's bizarre press conference, which maybe we should talk about briefly. I don't know if people saw this, but we have access to the BBC here, and I watched the whole 2 hours of Tony Blair reacting to the Chilcot report. And one of his constant refrains was, we had to stand by the Americans, like the Americans were this big, insane giant that could not be resisted and made him do this. And that's not how I recall that at all. I recall they were very much courting Tony Blair. And if he hadn't decided to go in with both feet, they actually might have thought twice about it, crazy as they were. Mm-hmm. But that was his line, like, we can't do anything. And I think that's part of the reason so many British people reacted very badly to Blair's press conference. It was a kind of groveling masochism all through his mea culpa. It was like, you know, what could I do? I was only the Prime Minister of Great Britain.
I was a victim. I was a hostage.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that isn't how people remember. They remember being persuaded endlessly, you know, hustled by Blair, that it was the right thing to do. And had it gone well, he would have done a victory dance. He wouldn't have said he was forced into it.
No, it was quite a bizarre performance. I mean, I don't know how much time we should spend on it, but he went through some very public guilt and some wildly emotional confessions of his regrets. But then he said the world is still better off without Saddam. And I'm trying to think, how is the world better off without Saddam? I mean, it's hard to imagine another end for the Saddam dynasty. His sons probably wouldn't have been able to rule very long, but it's hard to think of anything that could have been worse than what actually happened.
Yeah, I saw somebody, I can't remember who it was, saying something to the effect of, what Blair really was doing was sort of showing off his public relations skills so that he gets another 10 or 20 contracts with other dictators and human rights violators. Because that's what, after Nazarbayev, the dictator in Kazakhstan, oversaw that horrific massacre of the striking oil workers in Genoa's and sort of been, December 2011, I think. Suddenly they had this massacre on their hands, and who did they go to? Well, Tony Blair immediately wrote to him and said, basically, I can help you, and here's my fee. And it was like £8 million. And then he ran around everywhere saying, he's misunderstood and very progressive. Yeah, that's what he does.
Yeah, a lot of stuff that's been happening recently makes me realize, no matter how much I try to be cynical, I can't be cynical. I mean, there's Blair, there's Clinton, both the Clintons. I don't understand it. I mean, that line from Chinatown always resonated with me. How many beds can you sleep in? How many dinners can you eat? These people will never have to worry about paying the rent. What what do they need this for? And the story that actually really struck me was something that someone mentioned on my Facebook in the wake of the terrible Baghdad bombing, which has killed so far 292 people. Apparently the Iraqi security forces are still using these fake bomb detectors that were originally invented as a golf ball finding gadget. And they weren't any good at finding golf balls either. But an entrepreneur in the U.S., he's described as a treasure hunter, which means some kind of wacko, came up with this fake gadget to find golf balls. And somebody who was an ex-Liverpool cop, and I know some friends who will have all their Liverpool stereotypes confirmed here, came up with the idea of rebranding these things as explosives detectors or anything else. He said they could also find ivory or whatever, or drugs, and selling them for a profit of like, 10,000% to third world countries that were looking for something that could detect bombs. And he said they could detect bombs at a range of 20 meters or something, which is physically impossible. But all they were was like dowsers.
So it was initially called the Gopher Golf Ball Finder.
Yeah.
And then they changed it to the Quadro Tracker.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this thing never had a chance of finding bombs. And it was originally designed, of course, just to find golf balls, which was why it was called the Gopher. Then they said it could find narcotics. And then some American entrepreneurs started calling it the Quadro Tracker and selling it to school.
I just can't. I somehow see Bill Murray here. Growing your little critter. Can't really do his voice too well. Then, or you think you're smart, don't you? I've got the gopher.
with his little fake radar tracker. Exactly. I mean, it was that level of slapstick, except it was also unbelievable in its cynicism. I mean, it was eventually picked up by this ex-Liverpool cop in Britain called Jim McCormick, who sold it to various third world countries where, bombs are a very serious problem, claiming it could detect explosives. And the way it could do it is some sort of, Amish-level technology where you put a little card in a sealed glass jar with a sample of whatever it is he wanted to find, whether explosives or drugs or any other morally evil thing. And then you put the card into the little handheld device, and like some sort of electronic bloodhound, it then goes around sniffing out whatever it is you're looking for. And this guy was some kind of great salesman. He made something like $55 million selling this to governments like Iraq and Niger. And it was still in use in Iraq, as far as I know. It was still in use when the truck that carried this quarter ton of plastic, of C4, was driven into a crowded shopping district in Baghdad last week and ended up killing 300 people. And meanwhile, this guy, Jim McCormick, was swanning around, getting involved in yachts and buying a house in Bath and buying a bungalow in Cyprus, I think. And all of these places that you would have seen on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous back in the day. And one of his associates, hired tech people, so like a plausible case for the thing, said, I don't want to be part of this if it doesn't really work. Does it do what it says it does? And he said, it does exactly what it's supposed to do. It makes money. And it did. It made him quite a lot of money. I mean, he sold 5,000 of these to Iraq at a list price of $40,000 a piece. And this is something that is basically a handheld little plastic pistol with a fake radar screen on it and no electronics inside, nothing. You do the show and you have to try to be cynical, but that's a kind of cynicism I can't really imagine. And it's actually related to the problem of who are the jihadis, because you end up, or at least I ended up, looking at photos of this Jim McCormick guy, this ex-cop who did this, and what do you see? Just a puffy middle-aged creep who looks like every other puffy middle-aged creep. There's no psychological mystery there. He's just a nasty sleaze, like a lot of people are. Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine. How does a cop from Liverpool meet these people? Like, I get the bribery part. I get the part where there are... it was hard to fathom in a gut level, but I do get from what I've seen in Russia and, you know, what I've seen studying, let's say, finance people and cigarette, you know, industry people. But what right. I don't get is how does the cop from Liverpool hook up? And I just have to assume he's got some military intelligence friends or friends in military that, you know, saw opportunities but didn't know what to sell. Like, it made friends, made connections. Sometimes police people sort of mix up with with military intelligence people. I don't know. How did he get there?
No, I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, I'm sure there were kickbacks for anybody like that who helped him along the line. And he would have, needed to contact some people. I mean, he dealt with some very high Iraqi security officials, and obviously Liverpool ex-cops and high Iraqi security officials don't normally mix. So there may have been all kinds of middlemen in the process who were also getting quiet kickbacks for introducing Jim McCormick to whoever was the deputy minister for security. But I don't know. I mean, all I know is that these things are still in use at places like Sharm el-Sheikh. And you and I have both gone through... security at Sharm el-Sheikh, although, to be fair, I don't think we ever thought there was going to be any security at Sharm el-Sheikh.
That's why the whole package cost $300.
Yeah, we just thought we'd take our chances.
Yeah.
But I think there were Iraqi cops probably using these things in good faith waving.
People are wowed by technology in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is really one giant snake oil marketing scam. You know, look at Theranos, I think was the name of the company, and that Stanford woman, very pretty, serious-looking, blonde Elizabeth Holmes from Stanford, very sort of highly bred, had, you know, all the top VC companies backing her, and Henry Kissinger on the board, and it was all about how she was going to, you know, disrupt the whole blood testing industry, and basically, like Uber with taxis, was going to sort of get rid of the middleman, and then people would individually be able to do all kinds of blood tests without having to go to hospitals because technology had made it such that everybody could do it. And it turned out for 2 years, every single blood test was faked.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Everything's fake. There is no technology there.
I wonder if that's what happened to me, because when I was in Victoria, British Columbia, trying to cram several lifetimes worth of disastrous mistakes into a couple of years, I visited naturopath, mistake number one, who told me that I could find out what allergies I had by getting a simple blood test. So she took a sample and sent it through the mail to somebody in Utah. And the things I told her, like, I think I'm allergic to some kind of nuts. I don't think I should eat nuts. She read the form back to me and said, no, you're not allergic to nuts. In fact, nuts are really good, healthy food.
Oh, yeah.
And you should have as many of them as you can. So I go to this nice green, very expensive grocery store in Victoria, and I buy this handful of raw hazelnuts, and I chew them down. And here would be a quick cut to
me. I know, I'm imagining that.
Yeah, with something called calf tongue, where all your mucous membranes are so swollen that your tongue is about four times its normal size and sticking out of your face like that. So that I couldn't even talk or breathe. And they had to give me like five ephedrine shots in the hospital, or I would have died, because, as you say, those things are fake. And and worse yet, I had to get insulted by the paramedic because I couldn't speak properly. So I was trying to explain, no, the test told me it was okay. And she said, the paramedic said, Joe, you hear this guy? He knew he was allergic to nuts, and he did it anyway. This guy wins a Darwin Award.
Oh, God. Are you kidding me? He actually said that?
Yeah, she, yes.
She actually, oh, my God. That's insane. To be abused while you're in a stretcher. What the fuck is wrong with this world? Jeez.
I don't know. It was all of a piece at the time. And you know, we were also, that was when we were Dickensian poor, and something happens to you, you don't fight back. I noticed that at the time. She could smell that on me, and she got away with it. Hell, I should have sued the city. This was Canada. Once you make a fuss, you've got a good chance. But I wasn't in any condition even to make a fuss. But anyway, yeah, it was exactly that kind of fake blood test, totally fake. There is no blood test that you can send away that will tell you what allergies you have. They have to do the old skin test where they put a little allergen and see if it flares up. That's the only way. But I believe it too. I'd probably fall for one of these bomb detectors.
Yeah, because you don't know. You put your faith in it, and Silicon Valley's constantly selling itself. And you know, you do notice different changes in your life. I mean, the internet is real.
Yeah.
Google is real. You know, the smartphone, whatever. I mean, this podcast is real. So you just figure, well, these guys know things I don't know. If they say it works,
absolutely.
Some regulator had to have double-checked it. There's no way that, you know, it would have gotten this far unless it's been checked. And I'm sure these guys were good salesmen. I mean, that technology world is seems to me about 80% salesmanship, you know, 90% salesmanship and like 10% actual technology. We are at the point where we should get Alistair, our guest, Alistair Davidson, on the line. So do you want to wrap it up, and then I'll get in touch with him?
Okay, yeah. I mean, so there are several patterns we're seeing in the Ramadan attacks. One is revenge killings by Islamic State as they withdraw. Another is general xenophobic panic, like you see. I'm not sure it's a panic in Somalia. They do have a problem with foreigners coming in. Or Dhaka, where these elite kids decide that cafes full of foreigners are the problem. Then you get strange attacks, like an attack on a mosque in Medina, the one of the holy cities in Arabia. And it's hard to find out what's going on there because the Saudis, in their inimitable way, arrested 12 Pakistanis for the attack, in spite of the fact that the only person definitely involved was the suicide bomber who was found in pieces and who happens to be a Saudi citizen. So it's hard to know what's going on there, but it's, you know, the Saudis always pick up some foreigner when something happens, because God forbid that any Saudi should actually be a jihadi suicide bomber, even though they're common as dirt. So a lot of patterns going on. Some of them are not surprising at all, but very few of them can be explained by any of the available popular explanations, let alone the persecution one. It just doesn't work.
All right, and this story doesn't. I mean, it just seems to be snowballing. So I'm sure next week, and then, you know, and in the upcoming episodes, we're gonna just be updating these strings of sort of Islamic State inspired, you know. Massacres.
Yeah.
Wears itself
oh,
out.
Oh, yeah.
It's not going to wear itself out anytime soon, though. All right. So we should get off the line. And,
okay.
And then I'll do like one of those three-way calls with Alistair.
Okay.
But we keep the infiltrators close. We're honored by our guests. We understand the burden of a truth you can't express. So we'll extricate the details with hot pliers and duress. Confess. We're the consequence of all the smells and tastes that they've denied. We're the worms that broke the skin to surface, innocent and live. Most will die as maggots, but some of us will fly. Surprise.
Our guest Alistair Davidson, who is a contributing editor at Bella Caledonia out of Scotland, and also a Radio Warner subscriber, I think. But I mean, you sent us a really good letter that we read off in last week's show about Scotland, Scottish nationalism, and Brexit. In any event, that's why we invited you on the show, and so we're really, really happy to have you on. Thanks for coming on, Alistair. And you're in Glasgow right now, right?
Yeah, in Glasgow. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Well, cool. John, why don't you start off the interview with Alistair?
Yeah. Hi, Alistair. I mean, I want to start off by saying I know very little about Scottish nationalism. I mean, I've learned a few things about Irish nationalism. So one of the things that strikes me first is what are the parallels and what are the non-parallels between Irish and Scottish nationalism?
Oh, yeah, that's a question that excites a lot of comment. Especially one of the standard responses I even saw, you had this on your Facebook, someone said, of course, James Connolly was against Scottish independence, so your poster claimed, because the two situations weren't comparable. And that's certainly true, the two situations are not comparable. Scotland, it was never conquered directly. So instead, there was this national disaster called the Darien Expedition. The country put about a third of its wealth into financing a colony in Panama on the thought that they would just, you know, roll over these stupid natives and control a vital area of world trade. But as it happens, the natives were used to Europeans and considerably smarter than the Scots. And the Spanish blockaded it, and the colony died along with about a third of the gold in the country, I believe.
When was this?
This is shortly before the Act of Union. So it's
1700s.
Yeah, the Act of Union itself is 1707, so we're talking just prior to that.
Okay.
They followed a blockade by Spain and England, and a strongly worded proposal for a union of the Scottish and English parliaments. The crowns had been unified a century earlier, but the parliaments were only unified at this point. And I know you guys, you mentioned the Burns song, Persil of Rogues.
Right.
A couple of episodes back. which you know has that famous line,
the English stole the English steel we could dismay, secure in valor's station, but English gold has been our bane, such a parcel of rogues in a nation.
Exactly. So the parcel of rogues are actually the Scottish parliamentarians who took their fee for voting for the Union in that
right.
song. It's not the English in that song. So
right.
so that I mean that's the kind of the initial difference. And although there was certainly uprisings against that in the early years, it was very unpopular. By the 19th century, Scotland had bedded in. Ruling class Scots took elocution lessons and learned to speak English in order to represent the empire. I mean, although English was already spoken in Scotland, but to speak with a home county's southern English accent in order to represent Britain abroad. Guys like David Hume took elocution lessons and referred to themselves as North British.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Wow. Hume, like a lot of philosophers, was radical within his small sphere, but in daily life he had the same pettiness as the rest of us.
There were other guys around the same time who took a different view. There were some who were big supporters of the French Revolution.
Right.
But the last uprising in Scotland of any note was 1820, and that was pretty small and swiftly defeated. In fact, it was so well infiltrated that the police declared the rebellion. You know, they put out posters saying, "Oh, the provisional government's been declared, rise up," and then all the radicals rose up at exactly the wrong time.
Wow. I didn't even know there was an uprising in 1820. I thought 1745 was the big one.
Well, yeah, like the Jacobite risings were certainly bigger, but they were also less clearly nationalist in some ways. They took on a nationalist aspect in order
right.
to rally support. But you've got a very sharp divide at the time within Scotland between Catholics and Presbyterians.
Right.
So that the Jacobites were very much seen as champions of the Catholicism and monarchical absolutism. And so a lot of Scots, particularly Lowland Scots, sided with the crown against the Jacobites, and it wasn't so clear cut.
Yeah. One thing I have heard that seems very strange is that divide still exists, even in the city you are in now, in Glasgow. I mean, how serious is the Rangers versus Celtic thing? Is that a real sectarian quasi running war, or just kind of kidding around?
Oh, it's pretty serious. It's definitely calmer than it once was, but that actually that doesn't come particularly from Scotland's old internal sectarian divide. It was brought back from Ireland. So
right.
So Scots Presbyterians were settled in Ulster in order to form a colony in Ireland. But then in the late 19th, early 20th century, both they and Irish Catholics are emigrating to Scotland.
Right, because there are jobs there, and then there were no jobs.
Exactly, yeah. There was the industry on the Clyde, the building of the British Empire's ships in particular. So that's where modern sectarianism originates. It was very much about employment protection, as these things often are. So don't employ the Irish. In fact, the relative of my grandmother moved from Jersey and in the Channel Islands near France. And in Glasgow in the 1950s, she would be asked in job interviews, "Are you a Catholic?" And because she was a high church Anglican, she would say yes. And then they wouldn't hire.
That's the wrong answer. I mean,
yeah, I know. Someone else just lie, you know.
Would High Church Anglican have gone over any better, or would that have been just as bad?
I don't know. It depends. Your proper old-style Calvinists would say there was no difference. But I don't think most people would really pay that much attention.
What's the breakdown between Catholic and Presbyterian Protestant there?
Well, I mean, it's pretty secular country these days. Catholics are definitely in the minority.
Mm-hmm.
In Glasgow, I believe they're a narrow majority, because Glasgow has had, you know, a lot of the people who had the good working class jobs and became a middle class have then moved out of the inner city. But it's really not about, I mean, none of these people go to church, you know. It's, they can use anything as a symbol, to the point where Celtic fans wave Palestinian flags, and Rangers fans then took to waving Israeli flags. And
wait a minute, let's back that up a little.
Okay.
Celtic fans wave Palestinian flags and Rangers fans wave Israeli flags.
Yeah, I think it started as maybe an attempt to draw a parallel and probably a well-meaning attempt at solidarity by the Celtic fans who tend more to the left. Okay. I pulled up some stats for you. Apparently, there are, of the 5 million people in Scotland, apparently 1.7 million are practicing Church of Scotland, which is the Presbyterian Church, and about 800,000 are practicing Catholics.
Mm. Okay.
Which means a majority is not practicing anything.
Well, no, absolutely. Like, most people are secular, like across Britain.
I guess I just meant, like, is there some kind of structural sectarian thing, you know, regardless of whether they practice the religion, between the Catholics? And is it like Ireland at all in that way, where there's...
It's like a reenactment society of Ireland, you know. There aren't bombings or shootings or anything like that. There's some violence around the football, probably still some employment discrimination. Certainly, you wouldn't. There's known to be Freemasonry in the sort of higher echelons of Scottish society still, which is very much on the Protestant side. So it's still there. Like, you'll still see. People having fights over it, that does happen, but it's not the all-consuming thing it once was. Where it does survive most, and this brings us actually back to the independence referendum and to the way power in Scotland works more generally, is the Orange Order exists in Scotland as it does in Northern Ireland. So that's, of course, the sort of militant Protestant organisation. There's actually more orange marches in the west of Scotland than there are in Northern Ireland. And people travel from Scotland to Northern Ireland and from Northern Ireland to Scotland to participate in those marches. And there's a really fascinating article that a website called Wings Over Scotland ran, and where someone looked at the history of the Orange Order, and they found that they campaigned against suffrage in the 19th century, you know, against the extension of suffrage to people who didn't own property, against women's suffrage, against trade unions in the 1920s. And they were mobilised in previous Scottish referendums, but they weren't really mobilised fully in the Scottish independence referendum because they'd become socially unacceptable. So right. Although they still exist and they still have money and tens of thousands of members, they couldn't be ordered out as a disciplined movement to knock doors and persuade people.
Right.
Well, then that raises the question, to what degree is the Scottish independence movement progressive? Because I think these days, and this is pretty recent actually, you know, nationalism is identified with, you know, something scary and right-wing and deadly and fascistic, but, you know, movements like Sinn Féin remind us that a lot of nationalist movements are also very left-wing, or had been at least left-wing.
Yeah, I think the Scottish National Party in particular has been very careful to build an outward-looking, they call it a civic nationalism. So they're actually very outspokenly pro-refugee and pro-migrant, which in a Scottish context is quite easy because we're underpopulated by several million people compared to where you would expect us to be, you know, in other European countries. And they've been very clear that, in the referendum, the franchise was people who are resident in Scotland. There's, you know, various caveats and things, but if you could be ethnically Scottish and live somewhere else, you know, born in Scotland, and you didn't get a vote, and if you were a Polish immigrant into Scotland, living here and working here, then you did have a vote. And that was something we held very fast to. I think if it was to be begin to be seen that the national movement was seeking to, you know, had a racist character, or if it was became anti-English, it would die. It would not survive that. And the left in general rallied to the Scottish independence cause, like almost all of it. And by that, I don't just mean small political parties and so on, but the broad left in Scottish society. It's particularly in cities like Glasgow and Dundee, the big working class cities. Being a socialist is a normal and everyday thing still.
Have you seen a change in your life about the way people think of Scottish nationalism? Has it become bigger? I mean, did it matter much when you were a child? It seems like it's gained a lot of momentum lately.
It has traveled from being... It was an absolute joke. You know, it was seen as... even though the Scottish National Party had some respectability, the idea of independence was not something that was ever going to happen. For my part, I grew up in a left nationalist family, so my family were broadly in favour of independence, but nobody ever thought it would happen or there'd ever be a vote. But, you know, right. It was...
How did that change?
Well, the key event was the founding of the Scottish Parliament in 1999.
Right.
So that was actually under a Labour government, and Labour formed the first two or three governments in the Scottish Parliament. But the Scottish National Party built up... and as you know, events like the Iraq War, Tony Blair's less popular social policies led to their growth. They came into power, did very well, and just really focused on competency and sort of a steady social progressiveness. And that then meant in the 2011 election, they won an absolute landslide. Partly helped by Labour's leader being chased by some protesters and hiding in a sandwich shop. On live television.
Milbank, that was
which
Milbank.
Didn't go over well. And then having found themselves with a majority they didn't really expect. It's a proportional representation system. You shouldn't really be able to get a majority, but they managed it. Well, I think just over 45% of the vote. They sort of had to call it an independence referendum. And we went from polls saying that maybe a third of people would vote to leave to 45% of people actually voting to become independent. That was just through a lot of knocking doors, mostly.
But then I remember just before the election, everyone said that the referendum would vote for independence. And in line with what seems to happen with polling in all British elections, they were wrong. And the answer turned out to be more conservative than predicted. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, the polls, only two or three polls ever had us ahead, although it felt much more likely to win here, where I think we had about a 65% yes vote in this area of Glasgow. There was an enormous fear campaign. Some of the real headlines you wouldn't actually believe. We had Scottish independence will set back the cure for cancer. That was a real headline. Deutsche Bank analyst says Scotland becoming independent could cause new Great Depression. That was one.
Wow.
And the UK Defence Secretary even said something strange about threats from outer space that nobody ever quite understood.
Wow. Is there a Vladimir Putin fear monger? Did they say he was involved or it was going to benefit him? Or, you know, that seems to be the big bogeyman.
Someone asked Alex Salmond, who was the leader of the campaign, about Putin, and he said, well, you know, obviously I don't support a lot of what he does, but you can see how he's restored some pride to the Scottish people, to the Russian people, and that section got taken out of out of its context and put on every front page. But I think which is quite ironic, because one of the nationalist complaints is that there are no longer any maritime patrol aircraft based in Scotland. So, you know, there's all these oil rigs and not a single maritime patrol aircraft, which meant the last time we got buzzed by a Russian aircraft carrier, it parked in one of our river deltas, and it took over 24 hours for a British destroyer to arrive from southern England to track it. The Defence Secretary in Parliament said that was okay because we were following fishermen's reports on Twitter.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, you know, fishing boats work at Dunkirk, so what the heck?
What's difficult to get across, I think, about how people felt and why people voted the way they did. You know, there's a quarter to a third of the population who feel British and will always vote that way, and there's probably about the same who will always vote for independence. And for a lot of those people in the middle, they turned to the media to do their research. You know, the kind of people that don't usually vote. We had an 85% turnout, so a lot of people who don't usually vote in the last week or two of the campaign went, well, how can I find out about this? They turned on, you know, the late night analytical news shows. They maybe bought a broadsheet paper instead of a tabloid. I spoke to a lot of people like this, and there was only one newspaper that supported Scottish independence. It was a Sunday paper. There was no daily newspaper that did, and pretty much the rest of the media was solidly against, with these scare stories, including cure for cancer. 1 million immigrants, that was another one. It's a country of 5 million people, and there was, we'll need 1 million immigrants to be able to pay for our pensions. So with all of that, and in a sort of a cacophony, with street protests breaking out, real scenes of chaos in Glasgow City City. And then a shop worker would run out and ask if he could get materials to go and harass the media event. And then a finance worker would come up and shout at us about neoliberal economics, and, you know, how we were threatening everything that he'd worked for. And these kinds of, there was just sort of arguments in the streets all the time in a country where that's very unusual. We're quite reserved, usually. That was not our usual style.
Right. So then, just to be clear, Is there like a hard right, you know, Scottish independence nationalist movement as well? And were they for independence or Scottish nationalist but hard right movement? And where were they on this? Or are they with the Brits?
There really isn't. There was a very small group called Sheelan an Gael, who I think are essentially Celtic fascists. But I don't know if they ever had more than 10 or 20 members, and that certainly no one's ever paid them much attention.
I was just going to say, I tried to do some research on whether there was ever an armed or a military wing of Scottish nationalism, and all I found was this comedy relief called the Scottish National Liberation Army, which it's such a joke that it seems to have been a false flag, if anything, and Their caper that is most typical was sending a crudely lettered tube of caustic acid labeled massage oil to Cherie Blair, as if Cherie Blair is going to say, "Oh, a hand lettered thing saying massage oil.
Oh, how perhaps lovely! Oh, Tony, yeah. Could you please put it on?"
Yeah, that's about right. In terms of, you know, your far right parties like the National Front or the British National Party. These guys were all on the British side of the referendum, which isn't to slander the whole, you know, it wasn't the unionist campaign definitely lent more right, but it's, you know, it wasn't all a far right campaign, but everyone who was on the far right was with them.
Yeah. I mean, I just remember occasional moments in pop culture seen from an American's perspective when this would come up. Like, I remember the famous quote in Trainspotting, like, "I don't blame the English. They're just wankers. We let ourselves be colonized by wankers." And I thought, that's a very odd way of putting the blame on yourself for getting colonized, if in fact you did get colonized. I suppose that relieves any responsibility to do anything about it.
It does. There's this cultural phenomenon that we call the Scottish cringe, of which that's... It's sort of an example, or it's a deliberately, you know, sort of satire of the Scottish cringe, which is where people just feel that Scottish things are worse. And a lot of the Scottish national movement has been about not so much saying we're the best or we're better, but slogans like we could be a normal European country, you know, just sort of saying it's okay to speak the way that you do. And in particular, as I was saying before, sections of the Scottish ruling class trained themselves to speak... like people from southern England, and if you meet a Scottish person who went to a private school, you would struggle to discern the Scottish accent. On the other hand, my gran relates people at her school getting the belt across the back of your hand for using Scotticisms, and even much more recently, there's two languages other than English in Scotland. There's a few, but there's Scots, which is very similar to English, and the Scots Gaelic, which is similar to Irish. I have a friend who grew up speaking Scots Gaelic, but even in the 1980s at school, she could not learn to write it in school. She had to teach herself.
Wow.
And that's a long-standing system. That, I mean, that's been corrected now. You have a right to request it. But as late as the 1980s, 1990s, the remnants of these things are still there. So in Britain generally, you can tell someone's social class from their accent pretty much instantly. And that's even more pronounced in Scotland and linked to this national question.
Yeah, I mean, I had a strange introduction to that because my brother did a junior year abroad from UC Berkeley at St. Andrews. And he said he was astonished when he went there because he thought he was going to a Scottish university. But he said the bulk of the students there either weren't Scottish or were trying to pretend they weren't Scottish. They called themselves, or they were called Yas. And they spoke in almost an exaggeratedly English accent and would have nothing to do with him or the other foreigners, who included the Scottish people there, who tended to congregate on their own, while the Yas had a completely separate existence.
Yeah, if you can't get into Oxford or Cambridge, then you can go to St. Andrews or Edinburgh, I think is the way it works. Yeah. And there was a fantastic article in the Financial Times, bringing it back to Brexit, by a guy called Simon Cooper, Brexit, a coup by one set of public schoolboys against another. And the incredible fact about British politics is that these guys were not only at the same university, you know, the people on both sides, particularly on the Tory side of the
Boris Johnson and Cameron were like in the same frat house sort of thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And George Osborne and so on. But not just in the same frat house, they went to the same high school. Eton High School. So they've been having the same fight for their entire lives as a game. Now it's having geopolitical implications.
That's insane. So, let's bring this to Brexit. I mean, as far as I understand, Brexit's not popular in Scotland, and especially with people who are for the SNP and Scottish nationalism. And then you have the other part of the story, which is that Brexit is being... I have to say I'm confused, because on the one hand, after the Brexit vote, everybody, at least here and what I'm getting filtered through here, is everybody who voted for Brexit is a racist, bigot, reactionary, blue collar, whatever. And but then before the vote, the left was very ambivalent and confused. I mean, even that really great clip with... was it Mark White? Is that the economist, the political economist, I think, from Dartmouth? Scottish guy, actually. They're very confused.
Mark Blyth.
Yes, Mark Blyth. On the one hand, all we've heard about the EU is that it's the ultimate neoliberal technocratic organization. It's anti-democratic. It imposes, hierarchical financial control over everyone. And then suddenly we find out after the Brexit vote that the EU is the most progressive institution on earth. I don't think the left maybe quite has it figured out. Maybe you guys have a lot more figured out in Scotland, but can you sort any of that out for me?
Well, it's a conundrum, I think, is the problem with that. So there were sections of particularly the far left in England that backed Brexit, and there were these persistent rumours that, Jeremy Corbyn wasn't... I think he was asked on television and he said he'd give it a 7, 7.5 out of 10, which is an unusual thing to say in the middle of a fiercely fought campaign, but probably reflected where most left-leaning opinion was. The EU, particularly since the euro came in, is restructuring the European economy so that countries like Czechoslovakia, Eastern European countries, the Czech Republic, increasingly are just part of a German supply chain.
So
they, I don't have the numbers to hand, but some very large part of the Czech Republic's exports are car parts, and they all go straight to Germany to the production lines there. And it has the effect of lowering wages towards those in Eastern Europe.
Right.
But Britain isn't in the euro. Britain's austerity is entirely self-inflicted. It's a political choice that we made. But that Scotland didn't make and the north of England didn't make. I think where there's some confusion, so your working class in London overwhelmingly voted to stay in the EU. So they must have voted that way too. The middle class home counties voted to leave. And then sort of trapped between Scotland and the rich parts of England or the poorer parts of England, places like the north, the seaside towns, the Midlands. And there are people who are just very disenfranchised. And they used to be organised through the trade union movement. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the film Brassed Off, but you're talking like you've got a mine town, you know, it's got one big employer, it's got your whole social life organised through that employer and through the trade union. That's until the 1980s and Thatcher. And since then, people in those places, they don't really have any structure, like politically, you know, to express any power. They just feel their lives getting worse. My father-in-law is from Yorkshire, and he says that in the 1980s you could have a conversation at a bus stop about free market economics or something like that. People would have opinions, and today that's no longer the case. People are just very fearful. So it's a kind of a ripe breeding ground for far-right politics, which have been having some success there. And particularly just for people to lash out. You know, I think a lot of the vote was the working class leave vote was a lashing out at a political class in a situation where people didn't have any other outlet for it.
But that didn't happen to the Scottish working class vote, did it? They voted, as far as I know, to remain.
Yeah. So there's two big aspects to that. Scotland, every area of Scotland voted to remain, mostly pretty overwhelmingly. The overall vote was 62% remain. And here I live in an area that's mostly pretty heavily sort of post-industrial, urban working class. And I think we had 78% remain. I would attribute that to the discipline of the independence movement. So when I talk to people around here, just in the street, whatever sort of person, the number one question is, when are we getting another independence referendum? Canvassing for the EU referendum, people would say, which way do I vote for independence? And that's what they cared about here. It just looked like a fight between two sets of English Tories from Scotland. We didn't feel engaged in the EU referendum, but people care about independence. The main no vote is going to have come in farmers, despite receiving a lot of EU subsidies, maybe lean that way. The fishing arguably was devastated by joining the EU because there's one giant shared fishery with places like Spain that have much larger fishing fleets.
Right.
But outside of that, it's not very popular. And then from a Scottish middle-class perspective, I was talking about that cringe, and one of the responses in Scotland to say, well, we're still worth something is, oh, we're European. Edinburgh is the Athens of the North, and we're a European country, much more so than those people down south.
Yeah.
We're England's Canada, so...
Yeah, well, I saw a lot of the same thing the last time I stayed in Dublin for a while. There were a lot of people with the slogan, Europe is my home. And it's a way out of a really thorny, difficult history and a national identity that has been claimed by a lot of people you don't have much reason to like very much. It's a bigger identity and sort of a new identity that just takes you out of the British Isles context.
Yeah, I think that's right, and people can aspire to something a bit more, you know. It's also there's truth to it. There was a lot of trading with the Hanseatic League when Scotland was independent. Tens of thousands, I think, something of the order of 80,000 Scots settled in Poland at one point. So there is this long and separate history that ends with the Act of Union.
I was going to say, Sinn Féin came out, you know, Gerry Adams, and also, I mean, I didn't really see him talking up the EU so much until after the Brexit vote, but it's clear that EU, not the ECB, the European Central Bank, but the EU is very popular with the Sinn Féin left nationalist demographic, too.
Well, yes, I mean, to them, it puts them in a free trade zone with Ireland, no matter what Britain decides to do, and that is so important to them.
Yeah.
You know, they need those economic links to strengthen if they want to achieve their aim. So speaking of Ireland, it reminds me of a bizarre story from the Ukraine, of all places. I was reading a newspaper article I think it was in The Independent, about a Scottish unionist fighting in Ukraine. Now, in a Scottish context, a unionist is still an Irish unionist. I don't know if that makes sense. So it's these Orange Order guys, and loyalists. And there even used to be a unionist party in Scotland, which was very large. And that meant protecting the union between Britain and Ireland. It had nothing to do with the union between Scotland and England. This guy, he was out fighting for the Donbass Republic. And he was asked why. And he said, well, the way I see it, Ukraine is like Ireland and Russia's like Britain. I like that. He wasn't just in favor of the British Empire. He was sort of abstractly in favor of all empires.
All empires, yeah. That's broad-minded in an insane way. Wow.
Basically, the strong should rule over the weaker. And he's fighting for the right of the strong to rule over the bigger empires to rule over the smaller ones. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to read you something that I just found almost by accident from Stevie Smith, who's this English poet who died in 1972. And she wrote a poem called The Celts, or The Celts, if I can find it now. And it's from 1957, but it expresses something really interesting about the English perspective toward the Celts or the Celts. I'm not even sure which pronunciation is in vogue at the moment.
Celts.
All right, the Celts. And she wrote in a very nasty poem. Most poets are nasty people, as I can testify, and this one is especially nasty. She said, "I think of the Celts as rather a whining lady who was beautiful once, but is not so much so now. She is not very loving, but there is one thing she loves. It is her grievance, which she hugs and takes out walking. The Celtic lady likes fighting very much for freedom, but when she has got it, she is a proper tyrant. Nobody likes her much when she is governing. The Celtic lady is not very widely popular, but the English love her. Oh, they love her very much. Especially when the Celtic lady is Irish." At this point, we have three question marks appearing in my head. Okay, especially when the Celtic lady is Irish, they love her, which is odd as she hates them more than anyone else. And then...
God, the poor English, you know?
And this is the part that gets to the Scottish issue. When she's Welsh, the English stupidly associate her chiefly with national hats, estifods, and old age pensions. They don't think of her at all when she is Scotch. It is rather a problem.
that's unusual. Wow. Yeah. Don't think of her at all.
No, you guys didn't count as Celts at all.
Well, in a way, it's that speaks to some of the things I've been saying. The Scotland was very integrated into the business of running the empire to the point where I think, in a lot of English eyes, it almost disappeared. You know, it's the same country,
right?
And it stopped having uprisings by the early 19th century. There was never any equivalent of the black and tans or any of that in Scotland, and Scotland got a lot more out of the empire, particularly the sort of upper and middle classes, you know, got to go off and run large sections of the empire.
The most competent servants of the empire, the most effective officers, the most military or administrative, an amazing number of them were Scottish.
Weren't the American leaders of the American colonials, weren't they largely Scots-English?
I don't know.
No? Okay.
Is Adams a Scottish name? Maybe. But Washington, I think, was English. I don't know.
So that's led to a different experience in Scotland, certainly, and a different English view of Scotland. I think there was a lot of surprise and upset. As you can imagine, your poet, if she'd heard about Scottish independence referendum, the response she might have had. That said, home rule for Scotland has been a constant debate since at least the 19th century. And home rule meant dominion status in the empire. So, you know, much like Canada or New Zealand had for a long time.
Right. Would you say that the change in the Labour Party, I think I'm actually sort of paraphrasing something you said in one of your articles, that when the Labour Party betrayed those people who'd been working in the shipyards and other similar industries, they basically had no ideology. But unlike the English working class, there was an alternative ideology in Scotland, which was Scottish independence, Scottish nationalism, and that became their next option.
Absolutely. And you know, Scots find themselves in a position where we consistently vote for social democratic parties, first Labour and then the Scottish National Party. It's been the 60s or the 50s is the last time that we had a majority for a Conservative Party in this country, but we lived through Thatcher and then through Tony Blair and then through David Cameron. So you can see in that position, a lot of people are just of the view that, well, we should just get out and we can have our own elections. And even if we have a Conservative government, at least there'll be local Conservatives. There's a Walter Scott quote that's on the side of our parliament. I can't remember the character, but she's speaking. She says, when we had a parliament our own, we could aye people them with stains, throw stones at them if they weren't a good bairns, if they weren't good children. But nobody's nails can reach the length of London.
Wow, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Ah, yeah.
So yeah, to follow up John's question, I just am curious, like, how has the kind of political economy or the economic structure changed? I mean, it sounds like a lot of this groundswell comes from economic changes. But like, what was it like, you know, in the 60s or 70s compared to structurally, what's the economy like now? I mean, is it a mirror of Britain's in a sense, where there's kind of like a service economy and those people are kind of doing all right, and then a completely decimated working class or you know, closed mines and that kind of thing? Or
yeah, exactly like that. So the 60s, 50s, 60s and 70s, Britain had a heavily mixed economy. It was almost a planned economy. And that included these big employers, big steelworks, big mines, all of them with British in the name, British Steel, British Gas, British Coal, all run directly from London. And there's not much... You know, people would find it very difficult to support independence in that situation. If you work for British Gas, you know, and your whole community works for British Gas, well, you're going to be in favour of Britain. But yeah, Thatcher tore all that down across all of Britain. Scotland's fared a bit better than the north of England, but not as well as the southeast. And in the industrial heartlands, places like Lanarkshire or Fife, you've got these former mining villages that essentially have no employment or very little employment. You've got big inner city areas with drug problems and very low levels of employment. And so those links were broken. Actually, I think it was really interesting to see. There was obviously the terrible shooting of that MP, Joe Cox, during the Brexit campaign. Right. And the guy who carried that out was a subscriber to this South African magazine that was in exile in Britain ever since apartheid ended. That sort of empire nationalism is you find across Britain, including in Scotland. And what it essentially boils down to was a deal, yeah, where if you were a white Protestant, you had a protected status, you would get a decent job out of the empire. And what you find today, the sorts of things that upset older people, it's things like, you know, like racist older people who maybe have voted for Brexit, and certainly voted no to Scottish independence as well. It's things like black bus drivers, because that's a good job. So why have we allowed a colonial to have that job? You know, that's their kind of emotional response. So you see I think the remnants of that are right through working class British society. There's also this remainder of what had been a very powerful trade union and socialist movement. There's also this imperial aspect, and that's where you get a right wing working class reaction in Britain.
Right, against the EU and the Europeans, and more longing for the empire power. Right?
Yeah, I saw a Reddit thread, a UK politics thread, and New Zealand. Britain has no trade negotiators because the EU does all of that. So New Zealand have offered to lend theirs. And this thread was full of people really excited about this. They were, oh, that's brilliant. We don't need Europe. We'll get back together with the Commonwealth and everything will be fantastic. That's what we need.
Yeah, you know, I lived in New Zealand for 10 years, and New Zealand is very, very Anglophile, always has been, much more than Australia, which is ambivalent about the whole link. But even so, I used to teach writing, and every semester you could count on someone contributing a sad story about an old relative who had to stand in the long line in the Gatwick with all the foreigners while all these Spaniards and Portuguese and other people went into the fast EU line, and they would always end, and yet Grandpa died at Gallipoli or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can see how they'd want to get back to a marine empire, an Anglophile union of people across the seas, rather than people who are just geographically lumped into something called Europe, which England at least has always had very mixed feelings about. I mean, even in English fantasy, you can see the difference there. I mean, in Tolkien, there's a strong pull towards Europe and a need to be part of the continent. But in C.S. Lewis, there's this very, very exclusive thing to be as far away from it as you can. So, yeah, I can see how the pull of the old empire and then New Zealand as the loyal colony would always come back.
And this is the thing. I mean, this is all in sheer numbers, of course. Yeah, the Brexit vote would have to be blamed on, I guess, more the working class people. But there's a part of the ruling class that's always been very nationalistic for their own purposes. I mean, as you described in the stories about Boris Johnson and Cameron going to the same high school, I seem to remember the first big push for pulling out of the EU came from James Goldsmith, right? In the 90s,
yeah.
The referendum party and all that. And I mean, he's a pretty interesting character. He was like one of the first vulture capitalists, of modern times. And but he put all of his money into pulling Britain out of the EU, and it didn't seem to go very far, but it just was a reminder that this is also a part of the ruling class's agenda for their own reasons.
Yeah, there was an analyst saying, I think just today or yesterday, that actually the majority, because the middle class votes more, and actually the majority of exit votes had been middle class votes. Mm. But there was on what you were saying, the article in the Financial Times had this. I'll just quote a little bit of it. The autumn I started university, Margaret Thatcher gave her legendary anti-European Bruges speech, and this set the Boris Johnson and so on began obsessing about Brussels. Mm. Ruling Britain was their prerogative. They didn't want outsiders muscling in. Tory Euroscepticism is in part a jobs protection scheme akin to a Parisian taxi driver opposing Uber.
Well, yeah. What happens now then? What will Scotland have a second referendum on independence, as we've been hearing it will?
The First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, has said that is very likely. A bill has been prepared and will be put forward. There's a majority of pro-independence members of the Scottish Parliament between the Scottish National Party and the Scottish Green Party. So it seems pretty likely. It's all up in the air until the big debate in the UK right now is Article 50. And right. Article 50, is what is when you trigger that, you start the process of leaving the European Union. And until that happens, nobody will say anything for certain. But whereas in the first independence referendum, we had former European president standing up and saying, oh, no, there'd be this very lengthy reapplication process if you were to leave the UK to get back into Europe. Now the unofficial signals are very strongly you would be welcomed and very quickly. A friend of mine remarked that it feels a bit like England just lost a war. And now, France and Germany are saying, well, excellent, now we can take your banks, you know, we'll we'll take away the fringes of your empire, we'll really hammer you, because that way no one else will think about leaving. You know, they kind of need to administer a punishment beating.
Right. Yeah, and that's why they're pushing them to get out now. They want to make it painful. Yeah, I saw some of that, yeah. But what's also interesting, you know, hearing you talk about the way voters were organized, especially pro-independence voters from working-class neighborhoods and other neighborhoods were organized in the Brexit voting is, I mean, it really just shows the difference in organized voters versus, you know, disorganized voters. I mean, the issue of Scottish nationalism politicized a large part of the Scottish population, and then it made it easier to sort of organize why they should vote, you know, against Brexit and staying in the EU. Whereas with the British population, it's probably more like middle America here. I mean, it's very depoliticized, disorganized, and therefore susceptible to demagoguery, right?
I think that's absolutely spot on. That's completely correct. It was very difficult to do that. You know, I can remember, I just think back 3 or 4 years, and it would have been just like in America, or just like in England, politics wasn't something that people spoke about that much. I mean, obviously, there's political geeks, but then most of the population wasn't so engaged. And that completely transformed. I spoke to one woman in Springburn, which is quite a poor area, not too far from here. And she said, well, usually I just let my husband tell me how I should vote. But this time I've gone and I've done my own reading. Mm-hmm. I thought that was you know, just a wonderful standout moment for me. It was a very long door-knocking campaign and a very big build-up of internet resources. A lot of town hall meetings as well, but mm-hmm. with the media dead set against us, we built our own online media. And really, we only lost out with the generations that don't get their news from the internet. Mm-hmm. So there's Bella Caledonia, of course, which I'm contributing editor to. We're very much a place for sort of, you know, thoughtful and long form articles, that kind of bit, like, you know, something like Comment is Free or Jacobin. There's Wings Over Scotland. That's the biggest one in terms of hits, and it's a quite sarcastic media analysis blog. And then there's Common Space, which is like a news site that, you know, actually does original journalism. And between those three, we cover the spectrum pretty well. There's a few others as well, but I don't want to give you a giant list. But they built up to the point where those are genuine contenders in the, you know, the national dialogue. That they get tens, hundreds of thousands of hits in a country of 5 million people. That's, you know, very significant.
But how much of the success you had was internet, and how much was actually, because you kept describing this, and I found it so interesting, going door to door. I mean, I'm a little more skeptical of the internet's power. I mean, it can probably reinforce things, but there just seems to me there's still no substitute in politics for actually, you know, physical meetings and physical organizing. And without that, people are still pretty atomized. What's your experience? You have much more serious experience in this, so.
I think you're right. Like, without the physical contact, it's just not there. One of the most important things we did, as we knocked doors and we spoke to people, we also gave them posters to put up. And that took what had been a weirdo idea, you know, a kind of fringe, like maybe even you're a political cult idea, into the mainstream, because you're walking down some streets. And I don't mind, I think about 1 in 4 windows by the end had a yes poster. Mm. And, you know, when you see that, people then feel it's a legitimate opinion to have. Talking to people was, yeah, very important. I think the town hall meetings, very difficult to measure, but I think they had a big impact by getting people out and getting them together. And you're right, the internet, it complements that. You can never think that just connecting online will change anything by itself, just signing petitions and so on. Mm-hmm. The other important thing, and this was advice even from the party in one of the elections, you know, Twitter is a bubble, and you don't reach voters on Twitter. Mm-hmm. But Facebook is where you reach out to people. Mm. So a lot of us, it's kind of an untold story. I find this fascinating, and very few people have spoken about it. It was mass Facebook friending. So, you know, you just sit there, you make a public account, and you sit there and friend lots of people in your area, in your country. If you've got 4,000 Facebook friends, you know, the cap is 5,000. That's actually what 0.1% of the Scottish electorate already. So you start to form these dense networks that then distribute those stories from your blog, and they're actually appearing in people's feeds alongside social interactions. So I think the internet does, like, it does do a lot. It's very, very important. Mm-hmm. But as you say, it, by itself, it's not enough.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Okay, now I have to ask a really embarrassing question that I hate asking, but I'm interested in the perception of military history and the way it affects contemporary politics. So I have to say the word Braveheart.
Oh, you had to bring up Braveheart.
Yeah. What was the reception of that very odd film in Scotland?
I think it was quite popular at the time. I was quite young at the time, though I remember seeing it. I put it on referendum night. I thought I might as well, you know, I'd been up for 24 hours. We'd been getting the vote out. We'd been putting up posters. So I thought, right, I'm gonna have a dram of whiskey. I'm going to put my kilt on and I'm going to watch Braveheart until the results start to come in. And it really is a very strange film. You're right. It's pretty terrible. I think people generally recognise that. We get, you know, it's something that's levelled at us a lot. Is you guys, you know, you have this politics because you got too excited about this film. But I don't know if I've ever met anyone who said to me, you know, Braveheart's amazing. I don't think that's
I would have thought Mel Gibson's accent would have caused acute pain.
His accent's not too bad. We've definitely heard worse. And, you know, it's better than Sean Connery's Russian accent in A Hunt for Red October. So you think you just gave up?
Well, actually, it reminds me, when my brother was at St. Andrews, he explained that on the first version of American Star Trek, Mr. Scott was supposed to be a stereotypical Scottish engineer. And his Scottish friends at St. Andrews said, "What? He was supposed to be Scottish? That was supposed to be a Scottish accent?"
No, we knew Scottish. Actually, on the Wars of Independence, the Braveheart thing, one of the most astonishing events for me of the whole thing was that 2014 was the anniversary of the Battle of Bannockburn, when Scotland's independence was confirmed in the early 14th century. Am I right there? Yeah. Of course, it would have been 1314. So. The much has been made of, oh, they're having the referendum, you know, they'll have it on the same day as the anniversary of this battle, which was really a comment that didn't understand Scotland, because people actually feel they don't feel comfortable with that. They don't think about it in those terms. I mean, some people do, but that's a very fringe minority.
Scotland during the imperial period seemed to do a really sophisticated job of maintaining its martial pride of having withstood the English, but now working with them as equal partners, so that, you know, you didn't have to make that choice to be a doomed nationalist or part of the empire.
Yeah, and I mean, if you say to a modern person, the 21st century, in a Western country, oh, you should vote for this political cause because of a battle, hundreds of years ago, they don't take a lot of interest. They find that a bit offensive, but one of the effects was, so the actual anniversary of Bannockburn was months before the vote, right. And there's all sorts of events planned around that, you know, just by the tourist guys. Like, there was a reenactment of the battle, there was a new visitor center that opened up, all that sort of thing. That was in my hometown, Stirling, and the British, the Stirling town council is controlled by unionist political parties, and they called in the British Army. They had British Armed Forces Day. They moved the day to be the same day as the anniversary of the Battle of Bannockburn, at the same time as the enactment was happening, and they marched the British Army through my hometown on the anniversary of Bannockburn.
Wow. Well, I know some people who are British nationalists took Braveheart more seriously than it deserved. For example, the late and unlamented Christopher Hitchens, who wrote a furious review at the unfairness of the portrayal of 14th century England, which to him at least was a very important issue.
Oh dear! And it was very historically inaccurate. It didn't, you know. Yeah. But I mean, it's a Mel Gibson action film, and
yeah.
At least people, you know, recognize us for something. When I was in Thailand, and you know, nobody had heard of Scotland except one guy, and he knew about Braveheart and William Wallace. So I think we should embrace that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Alistair. Yeah. This has been really interesting. Thank you, and I hope we can have you on the show again.
It's been great. Thank you so much, Alistair, for being on our show.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.